Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, March 19th. This morning, we check in with Governor Josh Green. You may be weather-weary with the damage from the unusual wind and rainstorms in recent weeks. And with more rain forecast, we aren't completely out of the woods yet. We also talk about our energy needs and the drama swirling around plans to consider liquefied natural gas in our future. We learn more about the process to negotiate military land leases in advance of a public meeting on Monday, how to provide input in the talks between the military and state. Plus, we check in with Senator Brian Schatz as the war in Iran nears the one-month mark. And Lego goes local at Bishop Museum. From a giant native snail to a miniature Iolani palace, we hear about an Aloha Bricks exhibit that's a Lego lover's dream. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Weather and public safety have been at the forefront in recent weeks, and there is more rain in the forecast. We checked in with Governor Josh Green this morning about the tough calls that he and other mayors had to make last week, canceling several events. Flooded conditions and wind damage to our power lines created havoc from Waikiki hotel towers to condominiums without electricity. It was fortunate there weren't more serious injuries reported across the state with so many down power lines and trees. Here's the governor.
We did have two individuals with spinal cord injuries out in the storm, and fortunately we were able to life flight them once the weather cleared a little bit. It just is a reminder that terrible accidents tend to be more likely when we have, you know, no visibility or some of the roads get disrupted. There were large potholes when, you know, we got up to a foot of rain in certain areas and more in others. So everyone should be safe, and we have another storm coming now. It's called Kona 2. It's the next Kona low. So, you know, it's upon us. We're going to see some heavy rain in the next couple days. The first day, it'll be 2 to 3 inches of rain, we believe. And overall, the forecast for the four-day period will be 7 to 14 inches, but we still have to see how this whole thing plays out. So we're going to be real careful.
Well, you know, it is a concern because of the threat and just the saturation, right? I mean, driving around here on Oahu and seeing those massive trees that just, you know, were uprooted, so terrifying.
Yes, it was. And I mean, some of the damage was shocking. You know, we're still checking everywhere. There's lots of airport flooding, and that's going to be taken care of. And the road dollars will come in from the feds, of course. But yeah, when a tree goes down and it takes down a pole, you know, we had 200,000 people without electricity for a time. And I'm really grateful that got repaired. And now we're down, I believe, as of this morning, it was 1,400 people. But that's still 1,400 people without electricity, and it's very hard to function. So these are serious storms. Someone asked me the question, are they hurricanes? And I wanted just to tell people that hurricanes are based on wind speed, basically. In this particular case, we didn't have winds that were hurricane force. There were some gusts that were quite serious, but for the most part, it was 40 or 50 mile per hour winds. Hurricanes are like over 100 and 120 and so on. This time, the Kona 2, this new one, does not appear to have heavy winds, but it will be very wet. And so, again, there could be landslides, there could be trees, there could be power outages. So, you know, just everyone be careful, have enough supplies at home, and we'll keep updating everybody.
Yeah, and, you know, the call to close the schools, definitely, you know, a wise one. And just the inundation, you know, on the streets and the highways. And then on the neighbor islands, you watched homes being swept away. And the businesses, the losses for so many of those big box stores that had no backup or no electricity.
It's interesting. You know, yeah, I think that we did have to close the schools. It was the Friday before spring break for the public schools. And it's a little bit of a less dynamic day in general, although we care about every day in school. But I didn't want kids on the roads when there was no visibility with the buses. And I also was very worried that we wouldn't be able to get everything cleared because some of the storm came in the middle of the night and landed at 2, 3, 4 in the morning around large population centers. So we just had to be safe. Also, a lot of families wrote me and called me and said they were glad to have time to prepare for that decision. State offices were closed, of course, but a lot of private businesses were stayed open, but they could figure out ways then, if they had a little time, to either have an auntie come care for their children or even just have the kids come to work with them, or they could all stay home even if they had to take a personal day. I mean, there was a lot to do. I will tell you, a lot of people went to the mall, I'm told, and there was no parking, and everyone was soaked, which was kind of wild. So people find a way to survive and get through these things, but most importantly, when we look back, I like to think that we're trying to protect people from tragedy.
Yes, and you know, with the rains that are coming, we know that the soil saturated in some areas. We don't know the effect that may have on structures that are already weakened. But people just need to pay attention and be mindful when emergency management, you know, issues orders about what to evacuate.
Yes, that's totally right. And so, you know, we're on a call, a huge call, over 200 people every time, it seems, at 8 in the morning. I'm on the phone all night if there's any worries, you know, about dams or what have you with my adjutant general and Haima team. But we get everybody together, and then I actually hold on to that call, keep the line open for some time afterwards to talk to the mayors and their top people, and then the people go about their work. So I will say this. I think we had very good communication across the state, and I really want to give extra kudos to the mayors. They were great. You know, they were on top of it. You know, judgment calls in some cases, whether it's a dam or a school or when the storm touches Kauai, may not touch Big Island for another couple days. Sometimes it's reversed during hurricane season. So they all pitched in and helped each other, and that's what Hawaii is.
Yes, and shout out to our public servants, our city workers, our state workers, our county workers who are out there just keeping the roads clear and keeping people safe.
It's amazing. I mean, those guys just, you know, great. We sent them pizzas afterwards. Kudos to Domino's guys who sent the pizzas over, and we did a little bit of that. And, you know, just people were working hard, and they're away from their families. And, you know, in some cases, I won't name any of the names, but some of our top leaders had their houses flooded themselves, and but they went about their work because they're always going to put everyone else in front of them. And just, it's great. It was really good to see people pitching in with the Salvation Army and the Red Cross and all the state workers that were out on the roads. And frankly, a lot of the private sector guys understood too, and they were sending meals out. And just, it was an exceptional moment where people were demonstrating the spirit of aloha. But having said all that, I would love it if there was not too much rain this week, because it's a bummer when the roads have to be repaired or when we miss opportunities or when it affects our economy. So we're mindful of all those things.
And Governor, you did mention the concern about the dams with Lake Wilson and, you know, the levels rising so high.
Yeah.
And the concern about whether the state should take that over, you know, any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, we're going through that process. I think that a couple things, and it's been evident for a while, a couple of things we need to do. First of all, I've asked them to put more cameras on the dams at different levels so that we can see in real time where the water levels are in addition to the sensors. We are in an age where we can get a lot of good optics on things from far away. We're going to do that too. You can't use drones because obviously with these storms, you're also dealing with terrible rain and wind at the same time. So that's harder. So we're going to do a lot of that to up our game with technology. The dam itself, the one you're referring to, it has been a challenge because we want to make sure that the lands that we buy and the dam that we take over also doesn't become too large of a cost for the state. So they're doing a little bit of work on that. But, you know, in general, I do support that because I think for certain infrastructure, the state's going to have to be responsible anyway. If, God forbid, Wahiawa Dam went down, first of all, I would always hope that we give people a lot of advance notice that there's a concern. That's why we're updating by the half hour in some cases. There's 2,500 people that live just downstream from the dam. So if there was ever a breach of the dam, it'd be a terrible tragedy. So we have to be careful. But beyond that, we can invest in infrastructure, and we should. And that's why the state's responsible for the roads and a lot of reservoirs and dams and all sorts of infrastructure. It's the right thing to do because very few individuals have enough resource to not just own that kind of infrastructure, but to keep it up. You know, that was one of the challenges, I believe, when one of the dams was breached on Kauai a long time ago, that it just hadn't been fully modernized, I don't believe. You know, I could be wrong, but I think that was, let's make sure that we use government for the right stuff and then get out of the way and let the private sector do all the great things it can do, but they shouldn't necessarily have to be responsible for thousands of lives. That's asking a lot. So let me be responsible, and I've got a great team.
That was Governor Josh Green, who we talked to just within the last hour. We will have more of our conversation coming up after a short break.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than three decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance. An HPR supporter since 2001.
What we're seeing now is, with many of the top leaders killed, what might remain of an Iranian regime may be even more hardline than what existed before, be even less willing to negotiate with the United States, particularly if they felt they had this gun to their head, literally and economically.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, serving the Hawaii Island community since 1916. Learn more about its support for the island community at ktasuperstores.com.
Let's get back to our conversation with Governor Josh Green. We were talking about our vulnerability as an island state, not just with the weather, but also with the impact of the Middle East conflict on oil prices. The White House has temporarily paused the Jones Act in an effort to ease the global situation with shipping. But there's also been drama swirling around Hawaii possibly switching over to liquefied natural gas, LNG. Critics have been pushing back, fearful of the costs. But the governor has been in talks with a Japanese company to see if LNG can be part of Hawaii's future.
I want to be very balanced about this. Let me break this down. For decades, we've had high energy costs, and it's understandable to a degree. To some extent, we're very isolated. It's hard for us. We're so far away to ship in fuel and so on. But we have been too reliant on fossil fuel, specifically oil, for so long. I'm all in on renewables. I absolutely love solar. I like wind, too. I love the idea of using geothermal as long as we're respectful culturally. However, we're still using way too much oil. And now with the war, you're seeing what's going on. I don't love this war at all in Iran. I don't personally think it's in our interest or anybody's interest, except for keeping nuclear weapons away from them. But now oil is spiking, and we're very vulnerable. If we were to suddenly not have access to oil that has to come through the Strait of Hormuz, okay, we are in trouble because we have to have jet fuel as planes come in and go out, or we have no tourism, and then we have no resources. So, you know, I had very high-level meetings with top executives at PAR Hawaii and HECO and all sorts of people, and it just underscores our need to be more independent, to have more firm energy that's not oil-dependent. That is why I'm pressing to have a balance of a small amount of LNG, a whole heck of a lot of solar and wind, plenty of geothermal, and get us independent of this perpetual fight to have oil coming out of Libya and Argentina. We have to do better. And so I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. I was not pleased to read in the newspaper today people taking shots at this idea to just have some balance, some modest change where we have a little bit of LNG and a little bit of this and a little bit of that, so we're less dependent, so we can bring down energy costs. One thing that I'm going to give you right now, and we haven't reported on, but it's time, I think. The reason it can be affordable to do an LNG project as just part of our bridge to get to the future, is because we will get billions of dollars of investment. It shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that the federal government right now is pulling away from solar subsidies. They are not going to do renewable projects. Therefore, as governor, I have to think about what it looks like for our state. If they're not going to do that support anymore, we're going to lose our capacity to sustain some of those projects. But on the table, I have the offer of over $2 billion of private investment. That's what you heard from this company called JIRA that are world leaders. They come from Japan. Japan are our allies. That's a good opportunity for us. Another $1-plus billion from the federal government in the form of a loan to HECO to help them. And then I believe we will see, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars from the federal government in support of this plan to have a LNG bridge with solar, with geothermal. Why? Because geopolitically, we are necessary for the federal government. Our military presence is relevant. Not trying to litigate that in this short interview right now, but it is relevant that the military needs energy here in Hawaii. They use their bases carefully, which they in turn use a lot of energy. So we have an opportunity, if I'm constructive and pragmatic, to help our next generation have lower cost of energy. You know, kids are leaving here. I gave a speech the other day, 2 days ago, I believe, where I talked about how children are leaving because they either don't have opportunities, and this would be a good opportunity to be engineers and to work on other interesting things, and also to have affordable houses. It's hard enough to find a condo or a house that you can afford, but then you have another $400 or $500 a month of electric costs. It can't last, and so that's why I'm pushing this.
Okay, and then the concern about the errors in the report that was adopted by the Energy Office. I know that we probably have more access to liquefied natural gas from our country versus going overseas. But anything else you want to address about that?
I do. You know, if there's any error in a report, and there's a lot of, you know, we're talking about hundreds of pages of reports. I'll be frank. That kind of thing gets cherry-picked because those who are against LNG, and these are friends of mine for the most part, but those who are against it will do anything they can for the status quo. There's a lot of people out there that would love to just see us constantly burning oil or only doing solar. And again, I'll say it a third time. I love solar. I think that should be our predominant energy source in Hawaii, but it's not the only thing. You just saw us, because we don't have firm power 24/7, have, you know, a couple hundred thousand people lose electric during a heavy storm. So that was a hatchet job. And, you know, when people pick one or two pieces of data and skip over 80 pages of great work, you just know what's going on, which is there's a lot on the line. And it never surprises me when people decide to make a serious attack at any change. But my job is to get us to a future where things are more affordable. And I'm not going to just sit back quietly and let the status quo rule the day. I'm going to try to find ways not just to get housing more affordable, but to get energy more affordable. This is one way. It's really a pretty small part of the overall energy plan, but anybody who would see their fortunes, their political fortunes, or their financial fortunes possibly damaged by my innovation, they attack it. And the people understand that affordability is most important. And by the way, this energy plan is cleaner. You know, LNG is cleaner than oil. It actually will be cheaper than oil. And by the way, I have very few options given the fact that the federal government really is not going to help us with renewables. So I'm trying to sustain our renewable plan, and I just am not going to stand by and be quiet if people take pot shots at it. But there's plenty of time to discuss this and debate it, and I welcome that because I want us to do the right things for our state.
We have been hearing from Governor Josh Green, who we talked to earlier this morning. The Governor's Advisory Committee for Military Leases met for the first time 4 months ago. Lands at Makua here on Oahu, as well as at Pahakaloa on the Big Island, and at Barking Sands on Kauai are coming up for renegotiations. This morning, we learned about the process set up to get feedback from the broader community. The Military Affairs Council for the Chamber of Commerce of Hawaii is set to launch a series of meetings starting next week to get public input. It's a process with a new office created by the United States Department of Defense, now known as Department of War. Noelani Kalipi is with what's being called the Hawaii Coordination Cell. She walks us through the process of how the leases are being negotiated.
So this is an event that is sponsored by the Hawaii Chamber of Commerce, Hawaii Military Affairs Council, and co-sponsored by Hawaii Island Chamber of Commerce, Hawaii Island Economic Development Board, and the Hawaii Leeward Planning Conference. And they are working in concert with our office, and we are the Hawaii Coordination Cell. We are an office that reports to the Office of the Assistant Secretary of War for Energy Installations and Environment, EINE. And the department created this office about a year and a half ago because it recognized the importance of working to strengthen the relationship between Hawaii and the department and the military's services. And having an office that could report directly to the Pentagon as well as work with all of the military services on land use, natural resource management, et cetera, and the military presence in Hawaii. So our office is really focused on creating connections with communities, with the Department of War, and ensuring better communication. And we're focusing on transparency, helping people to be aware and understand all of the key priorities for both Hawaii and the military, and create meaningful opportunities for public input in the plethora of decisions going forward.
So you've got a direct line into the ear of the Pentagon, the Defense Department.
Yes, we report to the Assistant Secretary, and for EINE, that's Environment, Installations, and Energy. And the reason that's important is because from a policy standpoint, this is the office that has jurisdiction over all of the real estate, all of the environmental management and stewardship, all of the housing, the infrastructure, cleanup. And then it also has included within it some of the grant programs, like the REPI program. That's a Readiness and Environment Protection Initiative program that gives funds for community partners to do things like protect watershed stewardship, et cetera, on non-military lands, right? So that's, you know, really helping for a larger environment and working with community. It also has jurisdiction over some of the grant programs that help defense communities with infrastructure. So for, again, activities on non-military lands that help communities that are around military installations, right? So those are kind of programs that people aren't as aware of. So this is the office that has jurisdiction policy-wise over many of the issues that are priorities for Hawaii. And that's why they put our office there. So we have a direct line to the decision makers in the Pentagon about that. But we also work, each of the military services also have assistant secretaries with similar portfolios. So we work very closely with the assistant secretaries for the Army and the Air Force and the Navy, who have the same portfolios, so that comprehensively we're collaborating and coordinating as an entire department. So that's what's different about our office.
So yeah, you're in the trenches, your boots on the ground, so to speak. But yeah, it's an effort to try and get everybody on the same page.
Exactly.
And so tell us about this meeting on Monday. How can people participate?
So this is a meeting. This is the Hawaii Military Lands Discussion. And the purpose of the event is bringing people together. We're not here to make decisions. This is about bringing people together, creating a space for information, sharing, listening, and dialogue. And the goal is to ensure that community members have access to clear factual information about military land use timelines and processes. The event is going to be at the Ala Moana Hotel from 8:45, that's when we're starting the opening, till 5 p.m. We have a number of military officials coming in. We'll be having some panel discussions. We'll be having plenary session. We'll be having geographic breakout sessions. And there'll be opportunities for discussions with some of the decision makers and a lot of the military personnel that are working installation issues, which are the kinds of issues people care about. Like, how do I access the military installation? You know, what are you doing about water? How are you taking care of lands? So we'll have a lot of people there just, again, to talk and share information.
So is this everything from Makua on Oahu's west side to the Air Force telescope plans, or is it just leases?
Yes, it's everything. This is a big starting point. Our key thing, again, is creating the space for conversation and understanding, right? So military land use in Hawaii is complex. And we will have representatives from all of the military services, so Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Space Force. And we will be able to talk about all of the issues. Again, this is not any presentations or pitches as much as it is sharing perspectives, building relationships, and helping people to understand who do you go to for information, right? I think sometimes people get very confused, or they just see the military as one big entity. And this is trying to help break down the walls of who do I talk to about this? Where can I go and where do I find this information?
Okay, so if you live on Kauai and you're concerned about those leases, or if you're concerned about Pohakaloa, there'll be breakouts.
Yes, we'll have a plenary session with a panel discussion to set the tone and have different military officials. We're having the assistant secretaries come in from the Pentagon for EINE, as well as some community members, and be able to flesh out what are some of the key perspectives and priorities as the military is balancing their needs and as community has concerns and or has experience that have been positive to share, right? What is the 360 view of some of the issues? Then we'll be moving into some geographic community breakout discussions about West Oahu, where the discussion for Makua will be, about Hawaii Island, which is where the discussion for Pohakuloa will be, Kauai, where the discussion with PMRF will be, and then Maui, where the discussion about the current and proposed future activities on Haleakala will be.
And for the average Joe out there, they see stories, they see headlines, and, you know, we hear the governor talk about what he wants and the general talk about what he wants and the timeline. And so how does this meeting play into those talks at the higher level?
I think the concern is real that people feel like decisions are being made, you know, without information. And that's specifically why we're doing this, and why our office was created, right? To improve transparency and ensure community voices are a part of the process. This is about bringing people together and sharing facts, right? There's a lot of, I think, perceptions and information that may not be totally accurate. This is about having the people who are actually involved be available to talk story and share. This is our timeline. These are the things we're considering. This is the process and the stages in which we will be making decisions and sharing information.
Okay, and then just to put it in context, so in previous talks about re-upping land leases, this cell didn't exist, or this process wasn't there before?
Yes, so this office was created about 18 months ago because, in essence, the real estate decisions and authorities rest with the military departments themselves. So with the Department of Air Force, the Department of Army, the Department of Navy, right? And so our office was created to work with all of them and to create a comprehensive effort moving forward for the big picture of what does military land use look like for Hawaii. And so in doing that, we are also creating opportunities for more comprehensive engagement and information sharing. So that's what's different about our office. And what's different about this event is it is kicking off really bringing everybody together. We were like, okay, there's all of this information swirling. Let's just bring everybody together and have an opportunity to share information and people see and meet with, you know, and meet the people who are working on these issues, both on the community side as well as the military side.
And then as far as the schedule, as you go from island to island, you know, how soon will we know about those events?
So this event is bringing people together for sharing, and we are developing the opportunities to be able to engage. So as the military departments are engaging on different islands, and as we go out and talk on different islands and create opportunities for dialogue, we'll be sharing where and when we're doing that.
So not said yet.
And just, yeah, this is really, as opposed to, quote, a new process, this is really working with all of the existing processes and making them known and available for discussion for the public.
Okay. And then this may be above your pay grade, but I mean, just because of the name change, Department of War versus Department of Defense, I guess maybe some community people might have some discomfort, you know, where it's about offense versus defense, you know, because you always hear about peace and security in the region. I don't know. Does it make your job harder?
Change is always difficult, but at the end of the day, the key point is that I've come to realize is that the military and the Department of War is about protecting people in place, right, at the end of the day. And that's very similar to what we care about in Hawaii, protecting people in place. We definitely differ on some of the methodologies that are used, but we all care about deterring adversaries, maintaining peace and stability. And so when we come to the core of what kinds of understandings do we share, it's that appreciation and protection of people in place.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
That was Noelani Kalipi, an advisor with the Hawaii Coordination Cell, who we spoke with earlier this morning. The discussion on military land use and expiring leases will take place on Monday at the Ala Moana Hotel. Look for links on our website later today on how to register for that meeting.
I'm Anita Rao. More and more American men say they have no close friends. Podcaster Mark Pagan has been interrogating why.
Here I am in my 30s, you know, finding like how deep the layers are in terms of how we're raised and how hard it can be to get rid of some of the funky stuff that comes up.
A conversation about making and keeping close male friends. Join us next time on Embodied.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for HPR comes from Scale Staffing, providing offshore staffing and recruitment for audit, finance, and accounting functions. Learn more about services at scalestaffing.co.
You know, we've been checking in with our congressional delegation as the U.S. and Israel's war with Iran stretches into its 20th day. We heard from Senator Brian Schatz on our call-in show yesterday, where we focused on cell phone use in schools. We also wanted to know about his perspective on the escalating war in the Middle East, as well as any federal aid that may be available for the recent storm damage. Here's Schatz.
Well, we have to do two things. One is we have to help the people who have property damage repair, and there's going to be some public infrastructure, I think, that's going to need some investment, including at most of our airports that have some flooding damage, but also individual homes that are flooded. And so we have to help people actually recover from this particular disaster. But the other thing we can do in the long run, and that's a slower process, is to make sure that we're just more resilient to severe weather. And with the Lahaina wildfire and some of the wildfires, frankly, on the north side of the Big Island, you know, the weather is getting weirder and weirder. And this storm was, you know, once in a 75-year period. But a lot of these supposedly once every 100-year events are happening more frequently than that because of climate change. And so we've just got to build a more resilient society so that we're ready for floods, that we have fire breaks, that we all know our evacuation routes. We're not going to prevent these weather events. And, of course, we need to be working in the big picture on ameliorating climate change. But in the meantime, we need to do as much in the way of pragmatic things as we can. And in Lahaina, they're doing a good job of making sure that there's not enough, essentially, kindling to cause a wildfire. And on the flooding side, we can do some things in terms of natural ecosystems to make sure that valleys don't flood and homes don't flood and communities don't flood. I know in Waihole, some of the terraforms actually did better than others, partly because of the ecosystem restoration that folks did that made it more resilient to a flood event. It's still going to be very, very tough across the state, but we want to help people build their resilience in their own neighborhoods.
Yeah, the key there is resilience, right, and preparation. I wanted to end here just asking on Iran. It seems more and more likely that this war will continue stretching into weeks and perhaps even months. What are your concerns right now? I know you've taken the lead on pressing the Department of Defense on the bombing of a school and ongoing civilian casualties in Iran, but what are you most worried about?
Wars in the Middle East, especially wars of choice, do not work out either for the region or for the United States. This is in so many ways very similar to the Iraq War, where we have a tremendous kind of tactical military success, but what starts to look like a strategic failure. We don't have a plan to get out of this. And I think we underestimate the resolve and the resilience of a country like Iran and decades ago, a country like Iraq, which is to say, it's true that we decimated their Navy. It's true that we hit every target that we wanted. And the same was true in Iraq. But as former Secretary of State Colin Powell used to say, you break it, you bought it. And we now have a really dangerous situation in the entire region. And the price of everything is about to go up. It's not just the price of gasoline in our cars, but it's fertilizer and therefore food. It's rare earth minerals and therefore our electronics. There's really nothing that's going to be not caught up in rising prices unless we can get the Strait of Hormuz reopened. And the Iranians are saying, you know, no way. My hope is that the president declares victory as soon as possible, says we hit our military targets, we're done now. But I think, you know, we just haven't learned our lesson about wars of choice. Very easy to get in, and we've got the most powerful, well-trained, disciplined, admirable, patriotic military that this world has ever seen. But we owe it to them to have a plan for how we're using them. And to me, this was not done planfully. And there were a couple of indicators. And there was an argument about whether or not there was a plan and that everything was going according to the plan. And, you know, President Trump last night said that they were surprised about Iran's response. And I am surprised that he is surprised, because most of us in the national security space have been briefed as to the possible course of action were we to attack Iran. And it was that they would do asymmetric attacks against Gulf adversaries. That's exactly what they did. And that they would close the Strait of Hormuz. That's exactly what they did. But it's actually worse than that, because we always thought if they closed the Strait, that they also would be unable to export oil. They have figured out a way to close it for everyone else and continue exporting oil. On top of that, because there's such a global oil shortage, Russia's oil, which was sanctioned and they were unable to sell it, we just had to lift the sanctions to alleviate the global shortage. And so now Russia is the recipient of windfall, hundreds of millions, probably approaching billions of dollars because of this decision to attack Iran. So it is not going well. And the sooner we wrap this up, the better.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was HBR's Maddie Bender talking to U.S. Senator Brian Schatz. You can hear more of what Schatz had to say about students and phone use by listening back to Wednesday's call-in show. Look for it on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NereidHawaii.com.
This is Ira Glass. On This American Life, sometimes we just show up somewhere, turn on our tape recorders, and see what happens.
If you can't get 7 calls in 12 days, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, holy, what, are you kidding me?
Like, at this car dealership, trying to sell its monthly quota of cars, and it is not going well.
I just don't want one balloon to a car. Balloon the whole freaking place so it looks like a circus.
Real life stories every week.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. The retrospective Toshiko Takaezu, Worlds Within, covers 70 years of her sculptures, paintings, and weavings. On now, honolulumuseum.org.
Bricks that click. Lego lovers can get their fix at Bishop Museum, where a new exhibit, Aloha Bricks 26, just opened this week. The museum teamed up with the Hawaii Lego Users Group, also known as HiLug, to put together a crowd-pleasing show, from a giant reef triggerfish to a towering 12-foot wave and miniature state landmarks like Aloha Tower and the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. The exhibit also features murals of more than 50 middle and high school mascots. We talked with Roy Gal with HiLug, and we also talked with Bishop Museum Exhibits Director Brad Evans. He starts us off with how the museum came up with this local style Lego exhibit.
We had this idea a couple years ago about doing our own Lego show, doing an in-house exhibit at Bishop Museum. A lot of times we'll rent exhibits from different vendors from around the world, actually. And when we were looking at the schedule, one of our former employees, Ray Kong, he was our general counsel, and he is a big Lego enthusiast. And he said, well, why don't we do it ourselves? And I just hadn't even considered the idea. And once we started putting out the word, once we started reaching out for partners, there was nothing but enthusiasm in the community, you know, people like Roy and his gang with HiLug. It just kind of snowballed.
We also happened to have, totally by chance, someone from the mainland about a year and a half ago shipped a giant model of the Royal Hawaiian that they'd built in Lego in California. And they sent it to the Hawaii State Museum of Art without telling them. And the museum called me, because they knew our club, and said, do you want this? Or else we're throwing it in the trash because we can't accept it. And I said, this is not going in the trash. So it went into my garage. And I also know Raymond Kong totally separately. And I posted on Facebook, does anyone have an idea what to do with this model? Because it's filling my garage with crates. And Raymond said, talk to the Bishop Museum. So Brad and his crew took that model. And that is one of the centerpieces of the exhibit. So all these like different moving pieces just so happen to like miraculously come together.
Just like Lego, they come together.
Oh yeah, nice.
The whole event is really about Hawaii and what makes Hawaii special. What was kind of the thought process behind brainstorming just being this really celebration of local species, of local attractions?
Well, if we were going to do it in-house, if we're going to generate the exhibit, then we had to go with our strengths. We had to go with what we know. And so we reached out again to the HiLug team, who really have already had a great selection of Hawaii landmarks. And then we talked to our curators throughout all of the different natural sciences and cultural sciences collections and just said, okay, let's think about what we would want to create, both in 3D and in 2D. That's one of the things we quickly learned, is that enthusiasts like Roy and his gang know a lot about how to build Lego that we do not. I was one of those people who thought, oh, how hard can it be? It's really hard. It takes a lot of expertise. It takes a lot of patience. And they showed us a number of tips and tricks and showed us the software packages that can help you plan a build. And even then, it was so difficult for us to even do the simplest things. Like, we had to outsource, especially the 3D models. And so fortunately, Roy and some of the HiLug team members are just expert builders. And so when we said, well, what about something like Iolani Palace? They just took it upon themselves, and we supplied the bricks and they supplied the brains and the planning and the structure. And then also, the exhibit sort of has the Hawaii landmarks, that Hilug was helping with. It had mosaics, so 2D mosaics of the plants and animals that are studied by museum researchers. And then in one space, I reached out to essentially all the middle schools in Hawaii, from Kauai to Hawaii Island, private, public, charter, homeschool, everybody, and basically said, provide us an image of your school, your logo, your mascot. We'll buy you a mosaic. You build it. We'll put it on display. And then when the exhibit's over, we'll give it back to you, which is great because it fills up an entire gallery. The kids get to have fun. It's hundreds and hundreds of hours of building work that I don't have the staff for. And at the end of it all, the school is going to get back this really cool, I don't know, maybe 3-foot by 3-foot mosaic built out of about 10,000 different, not Lego bricks, but a different company's stud. And it was just sort of like a win-win all across the line.
And I really love the love of Lego. People really love Lego. And obviously, these builds are a labor of love. Can you tell me just what it's like to build a giant sculpture of Lego?
So back in 2019, I brought in an exhibit from the UK, and that one was Traveling Bricks, and it was all things that go. And it was everything from cars to bicycles to rocket ships and planes and ships, you know, everything. They were one of my first stops when planning this exhibit. I went to them and said, hey, we're going to need supersized sculptures that are, frankly, bigger than what Hilug can provide, because they're so massive and they're so time consuming that it's not the kind of thing that you can do in your spare time. It's professionally commissioned sculptures. So I reached out to my contact at World Touring Exhibitions and just said, hey, who built your guy's stuff? And he said, well, let me hook you up. And so since last summer, we've been going back and forth going, okay, what are the plants and animals that we want to pick? You know, what can we afford? Because we can't buy 100, but one or two is too few. So let's figure out what space we need to fill and figure out, let's cover our bases in terms of the natural history.
So there are actually, I don't know if the people who built it are those, but there are Lego certified professionals around the world that are actually certified by the Lego company to build these large scale models and sell them and be like licensed to do it. Some are artists like Nathan Sawaya, who's on the mainland. He's had an exhibit at Pearl Ridge many, many, many years ago. So, and they have like literally warehouses, like the studios where they build. Those of us in the Hawaii Lego Users Group in Hilug we're regular people with regular jobs with stuff in our closets or garages or basements or whatever. And it was actually a great stretch. It was an amazing opportunity for us to like push our boundaries of what we can do. And they came out amazing, I think. But it's all very different. And like you were saying, people love Lego. It's because you can do so much with it. So when you go to the museum, you'll see these highly detailed, realistic renderings of our local landmarks at like the scale of the little Lego people. But then you'll see bird model sculpture of a bird that's like 10 or 20 times life size, or these flat mosaics, but that are like photographs, but in like those in brick form. So it's all different kinds of art or creativity that you can do with this like pieces of plastic.
Yeah, so that was one of the things that I really liked about the Traveling Brick Show that we had back in 2019 was that everything was at minifigure scale. And so as a model maker nerd myself, I like that, everything in scale. This one, we broke that, right? This one, we said, okay, this section will be all minifigure scale, but then this section, we're going to use supersized building blocks, bricks. Some of them are almost as big as like a car battery. The theme was building with bricks and building stories about Hawaii.
And I think that's really something that's so special about this exhibit is that it is kind of an ode to the community as well. You really are reaching out with so many local partnerships with the middle school, with Hilug. I mean, I guess why was it so important for Bishop Museum, not only just for this event, but some of the events you've done previously? We've just covered the Konane Invitational, to really kind of focus on a lot of that community partnership and community love.
I mean, that's one of the big goals for us as an organization, is just that we engage the public in ways that are engaging, literally. It seems simple, but it does take a lot of work.
And even in our club, I think it's important, especially in an island, for people to feel included and not just to feel like all imported, like our food and fuel and everything else is. So the bricks may be imported, but the effort and the creativity and a lot of that is homegrown, like for kids to see what they've made and see that that is art, that it is part of a museum, is really powerful. To see that, oh, local people did this. It wasn't just someone on the mainland. They could join and be a part of a crew that does this kind of stuff. I think that's valuable, and that's how our institutions can like persist and grow, especially in the middle of the Pacific.
I have to ask this question, but do you have an estimate on the number of bricks used?
Okay, so let's just do some quick math. I had a spreadsheet from the commissioned works for the supersized, and those are about 220,000 pieces. The school kids, there were 50 mosaics that we sent out, and each of those is just under 10,000.
It's half a million right there.
There you go. Then the Bishop Museum, that was actually one of the fun things for us, is we asked the different departments, okay, you know, what birds, what plants, what snails do you want to have be the mosaics that will represent you? And then do you want to build them? And sure enough, I want to say the majority of staff members at the museum have had a hand in helping build this. And so, yeah, probably another 200,000 mosaic pieces put together by the museum. Then there's all the Heilig stuff,
which I would guess is also about 200,000-ish pieces.
So safely a million, for
safely
sure.
Safely a million, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we can round up to a million.
Well, yeah, maybe even with the white bricks and stuff they bought, you might be approaching 1.5 million.
And then I've just been buying white bricks for the free play area. There's a contemporary artist from Iceland, Ólafur Eliasson, who he has done these installations all around the world. And that was one of the things that we really clicked with early on when we were going, well, what should we do? Is he created these basically crowdsourced Lego builds, but only used white bricks. And it just looks really cool. It gives it like a almost like Greek statue kind of look. It looks very architectural. And so when you go to the exhibit and you go into the back, everything is much more art gallery. That's where the school mosaics are. And then there's a, I don't know, gosh, 100-foot-long table that sort of meanders around with just every brick we could purchase. I actually had a couple people, when I would buy off of eBay, I would buy bulk white Legos. And they're like, why are you buying so much? And I'm like, well, I want to get about 250,000 of these. And they're like, okay. And so they started looking for me as well.
It's such a creative art form, playing with Lego, building with Lego. It's just you can let your imagination kind of do the work.
It really is like it's a mix of like engineering and creativity, but with like in some instructions, and you can take it from there and learn. So I think it gives people an entrance to like do something creative and different and fun and still have a product that they can hold. And it really is nostalgic, but is also of today. So it's a really cool. And I really appreciate Brad for reaching out to us in the museum. I really think this is like a great example of the community coming together in something that's, it's art, it's play, it's history, it's everything. Yeah.
That was Hawaii Lego Users Group co-founder Roy Gall and Bishop Museum Director of Exhibits Brad Evans. They spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen about a new exhibit that just opened this week. Look for pictures and links on our website later today. That does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show planned for you. We highlight professionals who have been serving our communities for decades, what lessons they've learned over the years. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find segments of the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.